This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 12, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, Raleigh's Got Festival Fever. Building the city's music brand will require long-term strategy for attracting and maintaining key events. This article is by Dawn Curry. Bluegrass, country, jazz, rock and roll, whatever the vibes, you've probably heard it live in Raleigh. About 15% of the 13.2 million people who visited Wake County last year, including both locals and travelers, came for music events, many in Raleigh. Musicians from all over the state and the U.S. will soon converge on the City of Oaks with Farm Aid 2014 this weekend and the International Bluegrass Music Association's World of Bluegrass Festival, returning for a second year in October. World of Bluegrass organizers have announced that three more years' worth of performances await the city, painting the picture that Raleigh, historically not known for drawing music festival-type crowds, would be an up-and-coming music destination. Last year, World of Bluegrass had an estimated economic impact of $10 million, bringing in about 150,000 people into the city's streets, hotels, restaurants, and retail businesses, reports the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's on par with Wilkesboro's annual Merlefest, one of the state's largest and most popular annual bluegrass festivals. Farm Aid's headliners include Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, Dave Matthews, and Neil Young, and net revenues average $1.3 million to $1.5 million per show. World Bluegrass, for now, is a returning show, while Farm Aid is a one-time shot for Raleigh. But landing a big festival could be the beginning of an influx of similar large-scale events. Landing World of Bluegrass has been in the works for years, but without local festivals, larger attractions such as World of Bluegrass and Farm Aid wouldn't come to Raleigh, says Lauren Gold, Executive Vice President of the Greater Raleigh Convention Visitors Bureau. It's a key branding element to make Raleigh a destination for people that like all types of music genres, Gold says. Are we the music capital of the Southeast? We can't say that, but we are the music capital of North Carolina. That's the road we're starting to go down, and events like these help build that brand. The success of World of Bluegrass helped bring Farm Aid, he says, and it's because of wide-open street festivals that IBMA agreed to move World of Bluegrass from Nashville out from under what he calls the shadow of country music. When we went to IBMA in 2011, there were no signs in the airport, Gold says. It wasn't until we got to the hotel that we saw signs that said, "Welcome, World of Bluegrass." Nashville has a lot of music. Our pitch was, "Come be a big fish in a small pond." We know how to close down streets and attract people to Raleigh. The World of Bluegrass has moved to several cities, says William Lewis, director of Talent Buyer, Pinecone, and IBMA board member, and things weren't going so well in Nashville. The rising cost of hotel rooms and parking drove attendance down, making it hard to justify running the festival for a week. The same thing that happened in Nashville could happen to Asheville's Moogfest and IBMA's World of Bluegrass, and event organizers may be over-exaggerating the impacts of the festivals themselves. The 2014 Moogfest, in its fourth year in Asheville, lost $1.5 million in event revenue. Although festival founder Mike Adams told the Buncombe County Board of Commissioners in March that Moogfest was projected to generate $30 million in local economic impact, with $238,000 in tax revenue, the event generated closer to $14 million in economic impact, says Sam Powers, City of Asheville's Community and Economic Development Director. One-third of the people who visit Wake County spend at least $100, bringing new money into the economy. "We go after events that are going to generate big visitation and big room nights," said Gold about the ongoing push to lure more large music festivals to Raleigh. "They bring more funding. The Greater Raleigh Convention Visitors Bureau has not disclosed other festivals it is pursuing for Raleigh. Last year, when IBMA announced Raleigh as the new destination for the World of Bluegrass Festival, regional financial services giant PNC jumped at the chance to sponsor the event. "I didn't wait for the proposal to come across my desk," says Rebecca Quinn-Wolf, PNC's client and community relations director. "We knew it was something new and original to Raleigh." Quinn-Wolf explains that PNC has an objective of building community partnerships that focus on bringing down socioeconomic barriers so that all members of the public can appreciate and take part in the arts. "It requires getting behind festivals organizations, helping with monetary resources, and assisting with making connections," although Quinn-Wolf did not disclose how much money PNC spends on World of Bluegrass or other events. PNC is also involved in supporting the recent Hopscotch Music Festival in Raleigh and the Art of Cool Jazz Festival in Durham. "I think this is putting this region on the map that is going to be attractive to other kinds of music outlets," Quinn-Wolf says. "We've only scratched the surface." Policymakers, bureaucrats, municipalities talk of improving the quality of life for its residents with events such as the Bluegrass Festival, Hopscotch, and other events. But economic conditions often lay the groundwork for future success. If Raleigh is to emerge as a powerhouse of music festivals in the future, consumers must be willing to spend money on entertainment, and national data suggests that's not happening. The U.S. Department of Labor reported September 9 that average consumer spending fell for the first time in 3 years in 2013, primarily because of cuts in entertainment, restaurants, and clothing. While the highest income earners continue to spend more money on entertainment, the growth sputters for others. Solid spending increases among the top income earners have masked struggles for large parts of the population, says Harm Bandholtz, chief U.S. economist at UniCredit Research. For organizers of entertainment projects, the Department of Labor's report is nothing short of a warning sign. IBMA's World of Bluegrass contract with Raleigh ends in 2018. If the festival moves elsewhere, it could leave a multi-million dollar void, and Raleigh would need other events to keep the heads in the beds, as Gold says. Meanwhile, Lewis says the IBMA board must stay on its toes. "We like to keep things flexible and adaptable and move if there is new opportunities. With a move, there is a natural rejuvenation." Based on IBMA's success in Raleigh, a new venue would need a walkable downtown with a convention center or amphitheater within walking distance. "We get weekly cold calls," says Nancy Caldwell, executive director of IBMA. "We've heard from Lexington, Kentucky, Knoxville, Tennessee, Branson, Missouri. We need the right facilities for the business conference, the live music. We need an outdoor stage, and we need a place to host the IBMA awards show. Affordability of hotel rooms, walkability, and a nearby airport and interstate are also important factors. Beyond that, it's nice if there's a local connection," Caldwell says. "For instance, we wouldn't host a bluegrass conference in Las Vegas. We want to be around people who like this kind of music and are involved in performing bands and other bluegrass music experience." Here's a list of the festival breakdown. The 2013 IBMA World of Bluegrass had 150,000 attendees and $10 million economic impact. The 2013 Merle Fest, 77,000 attendees and $10 million of an economic impact in Wilkesboro. 2014 Moog Fest, 32,000 attendees and $14 million economic impact in Asheville. 2013 Hopscotch, 60,000 attendees, $1.5 million economic impact. 2013 Bell Share, 300,000 attendees and a $10 million economic impact in Asheville. Farm Aid for 2011 was in Kansas City, Kansas, had 15,000 attendees and $1.3 million was raised. Farm Aid in 2012 in Hershey, Pennsylvania was 30,000 attendees and a $1.5 million amount raised. Farm Aid for 2013 was Saratoga Springs, New York, 25,000 attendees and $1.3 million raised. The size and scope of Farm Aid places significant demands for equipment and services at Walnut Creek Amphitheater this weekend. There will be 200,000 watts of lighting equipment, 60,000 pounds of sound and rigging equipment hanging from the amphitheater roof, and 5,000 meals served backstage to artists, crew, volunteers, and staff. What follows next is a They Said It column here in the Triangle Business Journal concerning the festival of William Lewis, director of Pinecone. TBJ, what is the biggest challenge in pulling off IBMA's World of Bluegrass? Mr. Lewis, I know it sounds corny, but honestly, it's the weather. If you think about it, the key thing that changed from the model in Nashville to Raleigh is the outdoor festival. If it had been pouring down rain last year, people's spirits would have been changed. Luckily, even with unpredictable weather, we can move all 6,000 seats from the Red Hat Theater Amphitheater into the exhibit hall. We just need a couple of days' notice. That's a huge relief. That often isn't the case. Mr. Lauren Gold, Executive Vice President of the Greater Raleigh Convention Center and Visitors Bureau. TBJ, have you had conversations with other festivals about coming to Raleigh? Mr. Gold, we have, and we are keeping our eye on the market. We go after events that will generate big visitation and room nights. Of the 150,000 from IBMA's World of Bluegrass, about a third were within a 50-mile radius, and about another third were overnight visitors. Some stayed in hotels or with friends or relatives. It generated about 20,000 hotel stays. Lodging taxes are part of the hotel stay, and in turn, that's how we're funded. When we can bring in bigger events, music is part of the visitation brand. And Nancy Cardwell, Executive Director of IBMA. TBJ, do you plan to take part in any street jams when you come to Raleigh for World of Bluegrass? Ms. Cardwell, I play acoustic bass and rhythm guitar. I sing and write. I also play a non-bluegrass instrument, the hammer dulcimer. I fly in from Nashville, so it's hard to take up a bass fiddle on a plane. I grew up in a family band, the Cardwell Family Band. We played music at the little festivals and county fairs and Sunday school picnics. I toured internationally with an all-girls bluegrass band with the Department of Defense. I've played with a number of bands while freelance writing for a country magazine. Next up, Amanda Hoyle's column of Commercial and Residential Real Estate. Her lead article is entitled New Tower for North Hills. Construction begins on Kane Realty Group's 18-story, 300,000-square-foot North Hills Tower, number 2 in Raleigh. North Hills developer Kane Realty Corporation marked the official start of construction of its next major office building at North Hills in Raleigh, the 18-story North Hills Tower 2, with a ceremony on September 9th. Tower 2 will become the tallest office structure on the I-440 Beltline with 10 floors of office space atop several levels of structured parking. It will be located at the corner of Six Forks and Dartmouth Road next to the 17-story CapTrust Tower building. Neither Kane Realty Corporation nor its equity partner in the project, KBS Realty Advisors, have disclosed whether any tenant lease deals have been finalized for the 300,000-square-foot building, but office space at North Hills has been in high demand lately, now that all of the office space is now occupied at CapTrust Tower. In other locations around Wake County, Field & Stream Store is ready for the outdoor enthusiast. North Carolina's first Field & Stream retail store officially opened September 5 at Parkside Town Commons Shopping Center in Cary. It was also only the fifth Field & Stream branded store to open across the country and its second store to open in a brand new building location. The 50,000-square-foot building is, in a lot of ways, like a Dick's Sporting Goods store with specialty areas designated inside, specialty departments geared towards certain hobbies and work needs. But in Field & Stream, the departments are geared more towards archery, hunting equipment, ammunition, fishing gear, camping equipment instead of golf, and running and outdoor sports. T-Mac Sports Bar and Grill are looking for workers. T-Mac, the Atlanta-based sports bar and grill concept formerly known as Taco Mac, has set an October 5 opening date for its first restaurant in the Triangle, at the Waverly Place Shopping Center in Cary. TMAC is hiring for 150 job positions at all levels, including hosts, servers, bartenders, line cooks, and kitchen staff. Local industry veteran Kurt Larkins has been hired as the restaurant's general manager. And Moore County lands a new Harris Teeter store. Construction is underway for a new Harris Teeter grocery store and Pinecroft Shopping Center north of Pinehurst in Moore County. Argus Development Group of Charlotte is the developer of the retail project at the corner of NC-211 and Main Street in Taylortown, which should open in the summer of 2015. In the statewide economic development, the state State EcoDevo partnership sets October launch date. The transition team for the nonprofit Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, organized to privatize the job recruitment and marketing functions of the State Commerce Department, submitted its operating contract to state government officials on August 20th for approval. However, per state statute, the EDPNC can't receive any of the estimated $17 million in annual state fund allocations until 45 days after the contract is signed, and after it has raised a minimum of $250,000 in private funds. That sets an October 6th target date to get started. Now the hard work begins, Interim CEO Dick Lindenmuth stated in his update report to the partnership's 5-member interim board at its meeting in Raleigh on August 27th. Now we move to Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. Envisia has bright visions for 2015. Glaucoma and cataract treatments poised for testing. If all goes to plan, 2015 will be a big year for Neil Fowler and Durham's Envisia Therapeutics. The drug developer spun out of Liquidia Technologies late last year to work on new drugs targeted at glaucoma and age-related macular degeneration. Ideally, Envisia will see both those products enter clinical testing next year, meaning the drugs will be tested in humans for the first time, a major step in the drug development world. Liquidia, which itself spun out of UNC Chapel Hill, focused on vaccines and pulmonary treatments and reached a partnership in 2012 with GlaxoSmithKline for experimental drugs in those areas. Since then, Liquidia's CEO, Neil Fowler, says the company has been looking at other areas where it could use some of the development it has already done and targeted ophthalmology. With the help of $25 million raised, all from existing Liquidia investors, the company spun out Envisia to focus particularly on diseases of the eyes. The existing drugs to treat glaucoma actually work pretty well, says Fowler, but they require daily eye drops, and doctors say they are often struggle because patients don't adhere to the daily regimen as they should. Envisia's technology allows an ophthalmologist to inject existing drugs in the eye, and thanks to Envisia technology, the drug is slowly released over 6 months, meaning patients can discard the daily eye drops routine in favor of trips to the doctor's office twice a year. Because Envisia plans to use drugs that are already on the market, but add its time-release technology to the mix, seeking approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is simpler than seeking approval for a novel new drug, says Fowler. The $25 million raised is enough to begin 2 human trials, one to test the product on glaucoma, the other on cataracts, which Fowler hopes to see underway in 2015. Also, PRA Health Sciences files for a $375 million IPO. Raleigh Contract Research Organization PRA Health Sciences plans a public offering. It's not PRA's first foray into public markets. In 2004, it went public through an IPO but was taken private by Genstar Capital in 2007. On September 23, 2013, PRA was acquired by Kohlberg Kravis Roberts and Company, LP, for $1.4 billion. On the same day, PRA acquired RPS Patent, parent holding company, a global CRO, for $274 million, and acquired CRI Lifetree, a specialized early-stage CRO, for $77 million in cash on December 2nd. PRA plans to trade under the symbol PRAH on the NASDAQ exchange. $375 million was what PRA filed to raise in the IPO, though it will likely not net this much after fees and discounts are included. There are 10,000 PRA employees spread across 80 countries. And $712 million is the revenue for the first 6 months of 2014, and there's a net loss of $14 million for the first 6 months of 2014. By the numbers, under healthcare and biopharmaceuticals, there's a Raleigh physician shortage. A dearth of primary care physicians has been much discussed in the past few years. Better Doctor, which built software to help patients find primary care doctors, crunched the numbers to find the cities with the most and least primary care doctors per population. There is a chart that shows the number of residents per primary care doctor. Columbus, Ohio has 2,233 people per doctor. Chicago, Illinois has 2,375. Albuquerque, New Mexico, 2,484 people per doctor. And Phoenix, Arizona has 2,486, which is less than Raleigh at 2,518 population per doctor. And all of the above are exceedingly small compared to San Antonio, Texas, at 3,820 population per doctor. And to give you a size of scope, New York City has 6,536 people per doctor. Under the market watch, there's a bell-ringing moment for the BDSI team. The top brass from a local biopharmaceutical company basked in a bit of the Wall Street limelight. Members of the team at BioDelivery Sciences International, a drug developer based in Raleigh, rang the opening bell on September 4. Making the trip to New York include those from the management team, like CEO Mark Sergo, head of product development Andrew Finn, CFO Ernest DiPalantino, and head of corporate development Al Medwar, as well as the chairman of the board Frank O'Donnell, and outside counsel Larry Robbins, among others, were there at the bell ringing. Lauren Onisarge's column about technology and entrepreneurship leads off with betting big on co-working space. Michael Kimsall's new operation is no HQ Raleigh. We're not trying to be, he says. It's no American Underground. Not what we're going for, he reiterates. And while Kimsall was a member for years, it's no Bull City co-working either. Kimsall's just opened Wake Forest co-working space, isn't trying to fill any entrepreneurial gaps in the triangle. But it is offering a slower-paced, relaxed vibe for remote workers trying to get off their kitchen table and into an environment where they can focus. Kimsall, an independent software consultant, used to work out of his Youngsville house. Cabin fever pushed him to Bull City co-working, but driving daily from Youngsville to Durham wasn't ideal. So after gauging there was interest, he signed a lease deal for 1,200 square feet at 335 South White Street, the main drag of downtown Wake Forest. And there's an option to expand into an additional 1,500 square feet, should his co-working experiment take off. So far, six co-workers have signed on with room for 10 more, possibly 20 more if he decides to spill into the additional space. Prices vary, starting at $69 per month for night owl privileges, after-hours access to the common area and 8 desks, from 5 p.m. to midnight. The most expensive plan is $400 per month for a private office with lockable doors. Kimsall is funding the effort out of his own pocket, but through word of mouth and through some Craigslist ads, he already almost has broken even. Right now, the bulk of his clientele is made up of independent web professionals, and they're not just attracted to the location. I meet people at HQ, and I go to American Underground, and parking, if it's not a challenge, it becomes another expense, he notes. The possibilities now between cheap laptops, mobile phones, all that kind of stuff, just compared to 15 years ago, it's night and day in how productive you can be from anywhere. This week's funding report includes the fact that Triangle Firms nabbed $38 million in funding in August of 2014. Triangle Companies raised about $38 million in new venture financing. That's according to securities filings, which disclose funding acquired from accredited and institutional investors through both equity and debt investments. And while it seems like a big sum, it's quite a shrink from the more than $200 million local companies raised in July. The sum includes real estate deals. August's biggest deal was a $10.3 million capital infusion by Novan, a dermatology startup, followed by tech firm Clinverse, with a $9 million raise. Biotech ruled the 18 deals in August, with five investments totaling more than $14.2 million. The top 10 deals in August were $10.3 million for Novan, $9 million for Clinverse, $5.2 million for Windsor Circle, $5 million for Validic, $3.2 million for Infusion Medical, $2.4 million for CCC The Edison, $700,000 for Waste Zero, and $551,000 for Galaxy Diagnostics. Kindheart got $381,000, and CVMB took in $300,000. This column's They Said It includes Jesse Lipson, Citrix Vice President and General Manager of Documents and Cloud, speaking on the first day of Citrix downtown Raleigh move. He's quoted as saying, "We've been pretty successful. I would say Raleigh has been a very successful location for Citrix in terms of hiring talent." Also, Maria Tafuri is quoted. She is the RTP-based director for IBM's Innovation Centers and Ecosystem Development, and she says a planned development innovation center will connect entrepreneurs with IBM technology. She's quoted as saying, "We are at the beginning stages of exploring opportunities in the area." Dawn Curry's column this week covers small business personalities and triangle trends. This week's lifestyle trends include the latest wedding extravaganza, handcrafted books. Recording the story for posterity can cost more than $10,000. A Cary businesswoman is tackling the niche market of high-end luxury wedding products with a new concept in capturing the story. Wedding Story Writer, a company formed in 2011, creates an heirloom product for big-budget weddings, a handcrafted storybook about the day of your wedding. Michelle Murray DeLuce founded the business as a stay-at-home mom who'd recently finished her master's degree in operations management. She spent several years working for Nortel and GlaxoSmithKline until she had her third child. Now she works from home when she's not traveling to trade shows and weddings around the country. DeLuce has two writers on the East Coast, two on the West Coast, and has contracts with graphic designers, papermakers, a local letterpress specialist, artisan printer, artist, a poet, and book printers in other countries, including one in Poland who says she prints books for the Pope. DeLuce consults with the bride and groom on the design of their book. The day of the wedding, the team spends time with family members, guests, and generally observes and takes notes. "I call myself a fly on the wall," says DeLuce. "I write all the notes by hand. I need to feel what is happening. I'm very emotionally involved." She becomes part of the bridal party for the day and consults for months after the wedding with the bride and groom to make sure every detail is ironed out before final printing. Some of her products top $10,000. The base price of the luxury product, something the niche businesswoman says will be maintained and handed down for generations, starts at $4,000. That doesn't include writers' travel expenses, which can cost around $2,000 each, depending on where they need to go. DeLuce says her company handles weddings all over the world. "I'm going to California for a wedding. I've got one coming up in Boston. There's a show in New York I'm going to. I was offered a trip to Greece to see a venue, but it conflicts with the New York show," she explains. While it seems that many high-end weddings are happening in California and New York, DeLuce says plenty of them happen in the South. Baton Rouge has a large luxury wedding market, so does Dallas and Atlanta, she says, adding that she heard of recent wedding in the Triangle for which the budget eclipsed $120,000. While she enjoys the traveling and the wedding she attends, Deluce says she's figuring out everything from scratch. The biggest challenge is being in a new niche industry, she says. It's getting people to understand what it is I do. There are people in the world writing wedding stories, but not in an artistic way. They have them thrown into an inexpensive manufactured book, and I've only seen one overseas doing that. Beth Stewart, director of Redress Raleigh, on its effort to ramp up offerings and increase in its network, is quoted as saying, "Over the next 18 months, Redress is focused on bringing together stakeholders, including creators, manufacturers, and customers who are invested in making the fashion and textiles industries more environmentally and socially responsible. Being part of the Redress movement through membership provides individuals and businesses with a community of collaborative and trustworthy changemakers who are willing to share tips and resources." Under the classification of transportation, here's an interesting want ad. Millennial truck drivers. It seems that baby boomers are aging out of the trucking industry, leaving a 30,000 driver void that the American Trucking Association says could grow to more than 100,000 by 2016. Incoming ATA Chairman of the Board Dwayne Long, CEO of Raleigh-based trucking company Longistics, says he plans to change that. "It's one of my greatest challenges and one of the things I intend to work the hardest at. I myself was recruited as a young person," Long says. "The gravity of the shortage won't be felt until it starts to take longer to receive online orders and it gets harder to stock grocery store shelves. We have to attract young people into our industry," Long says. "We are studying how the millennial generation gets its information. We are studying how social media works and trying to make our industry available by showing young people what we're all about." This week's executive voice question and answer is Mr. Tom Ferguson. This column was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle, and it's titled "How He Turned Donuts into Dollars." Ryes Biscuits and Donuts owners shares his recipe for success. Squeezed in a small space between a frozen yogurt shop and a State Farm insurance agency in a South Durham shopping center, Chef Tom Ferguson's restaurant is launching a renaissance in the breakfast market. When Ferguson opened Ryes Biscuits and Donuts in 2012, lines snaked out the door with people waiting an hour for their treats, some sprinkled with salted caramel or maple bacon or filled with chocolate. Since then, Ferguson and his business partner, store manager Brian Wiles, have fine-tuned their operation to cut wait times to minutes and improve profit margins to between 25 and 28%. It's the first year Ryes made $1.7 million in revenue and grew to $1.3 million in the second year from a 1,400-square-foot shop that's open from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. daily. In August, Ferguson launched a plan to franchise the Ryes restaurant concept in partnership with national business franchise agency FranSmart. Triangle Business Journal. How did you get into the restaurant business? Mr. Ferguson. I was about to get out of the Army, and I took a test about what career fits your personality. My first one was a politician. The second was a chef. I didn't really want to be a politician, but a chef? I could probably do that. I used to throw all kinds of parties in high schools, and my friends would tell me what a good cook I am. TBJ. Then what? Mr. Ferguson. In 1988, I got out of the Army and moved to Austin, Texas. I went to a little rinky-dink culinary school and worked at the Marriott for $14 an hour. First thing they told me I did well was biscuits. But our manager, Brian Wiles, was the one who actually developed the recipe for our biscuits. TBJ. Since you mentioned the biscuits, is there a secret to the recipe? Mr. Ferguson. It has a little egg in it, which helps hold it all together and still keep it flaky. We use 100% butter, no lard or margarine. TBJ. What happened to get you from Austin to Durham? Mr. Ferguson. I moved from Austin to D.C., back to Austin, then attended the Culinary Institute of New York. My first internship was in Dallas with the Mansion at Turtle Creek, where I met my wife. I really wanted to do catering, and I figured California would be the best place to do it. I joined with a couple of partners in Malibu with the Along Came Mary catering business. We worked with a lot of celebrities. TBJ, really? Like who? Mr. Ferguson, Harrison Ford. We did a couple of parties at his house, including his mother's birthday party, Barbara Streisand's 50th party. It wasn't that big, less than 100 people, and it was at John Peters' house in Bel Air, who used to be head of Sony Pictures. TBJ, why did you leave? Mr. Ferguson, the Rodney King riots hit. My wife was at an independent music company. She got a job with Mammoth Records in Carrboro, and I followed her here. My first job was at Nana's when it had only been open 3 months. I worked for Scott Howell on Valentine's Day, and he agreed to hire both me and my brother, Dan Ferguson, now owner of the original Q-Shock. It was a fun and exciting time. I left Nana's to go to work with Ben Barker at Magnolia Grill. Then I went back to Dallas for a year. TBJ, why did you come back? Mr. Ferguson, Scott had bought Pops and told me that if I would come back, he'd help me open a catering company. We started Durham Catering Company in 2000, and after 2 years, I bought him out. TBJ, you are also one of the founders of Only Burger, one of the first successful food truck concepts in the Triangle. How did that happen? Mr. Ferguson, I'm a big Dallas Cowboys fan, and about 5 years ago, I was watching a game and saw a sign for In-N-Out Burger on the sideline. I called up my friend Sam Poley and told him that we should do it. We go out and buy a $65,000 food truck and start selling burgers. I had no idea a food truck movement was happening, but Only Burger was a hit right off the bat. TBJ, have you thought about opening another Rise location in the Triangle? Mr. Ferguson, that's actually how this whole franchise thing got started. When we opened, I gave Brian Wiles a salary plus 25% of the profit. He's doing pretty well, so we started talking about opening another store. About that time, we were approached by FranSmart. But Brian and I are cooks, not project managers or finance people. And I reached out to Andy Siemens, an old friend, and he'll be our CFO. TBJ, do you cook at home? Mr. Ferguson, sometimes. We have a wood-burning pizza oven. It's my dream kitchen, but my kids are picky eaters. TBJ, do you feel like you've had any big missed opportunities? Mr. Ferguson, I don't feel like I've left anything on the table. My two biggest regrets, leaving Nana's the first time, turned into something bigger. Same when I left Along Came Mary. It's always a bad decision when you try to follow the money. When the decision was about food, it was always right. This week's column about small business is by James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. This week's column is entitled Maintain the Family Business. So many family businesses in their third and second generation of family ownership seem almost destined to fall on hard times. One of the reasons is that they stop behaving like family businesses. Virtually all family companies start as entrepreneurial enterprises, with one hardworking leader surrounded by family members who chip in time, talent, capital, and encouragement. The ones that grow into stable, prosperous companies do so largely because of the family dedication to the dream and a willingness to work hard and delay the payoff until the business is really up and rolling. Those characteristics usually carry the business through its first generation until the founder's retirement and often into the next generation of family ownership. Then some family-owned businesses start to behave like other kinds of businesses. Oh, they retain all the complexities of family dynamics intermingled with business imperatives, but the entrepreneurial fire in the belly, the all-for-one and one-for-all commitment that turned a storefront idea into a marketplace contender sort of dwindles away. Management in the groove is replaced by management in the rut. Family team spirit degenerates into cold concern for the bottom line and the annual profits report and an aloofness for the daily ups and downs of keeping the business running. That's when the heartaches begin for the family businesses. What can family businesses do to hold on to the wonderful characteristics that gave them life and the prospect of longevity? Maybe you'd like to try a couple of these ideas. Keep innovating. It makes good strategic sense to stick to the business you know and that you're known for, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't push the envelope. Foster an idea of curiosity, experimentation, research, and development within the business and the family. Keep putting out the call for new ideas, for better ways of doing what you're already doing well. Post rewards for family members who come up with improvements that make the business stronger and that keep its spirit alive. Keep cultivating family entrepreneurs. There's not much that equals the mixture of enthusiasm, fear, and satisfaction that's generated by an entrepreneurial effort. It's a genuine high for people in business, and it carries many family companies through some of their toughest and most vulnerable years. Keep it going by urging the upcoming generation to spin off or create subsidiaries or related businesses from the parent company. Carefully cultivating new family entrepreneurs can not only strengthen the family's overall market position, it can also take the pressure off the succession chain, and it keeps that fire burning in the family's belly. Keep marketing the business to the family. I've long recommended this as a succession planning strategy, but a continuing marketing effort that targets those family members closest to the business is also a good way to keep everyone's interest alive and commitment high. Put out a newsletter that keeps the family informed about the business's happenings and progress. Have an annual family retreat and tour of the plant. Make summer jobs available to nephews and nieces. Do whatever you can to keep the family aware that the business is a living, breathing feature of the family's life, present and future. Keep doing nice things for people. A strong, vibrant business that's committed to the welfare of the family that owns it and also to its employees and its community usually attracts a similar commitment in return. It's the responsibility of company leadership to maintain a policy of reaching out to family members and helping to meet their needs. I'm not suggesting that the business should be a honeypot into which every family member is invited to stick a paw, but while keeping a prudent eye on the resources and preserving the business for the family's future, try also to keep giving the family some kind of valuable return on their investments of interest, effort, and support. It's another way to keep alive the very positive differences that make family businesses so special. Next up, patents. North Carolina legislation targets litigation-hungry patent trolls. Dodging iffy infringement suits is costly and time-consuming. Patent trolls are increasingly becoming a problem for scores of Triangle Tech companies, a trend that has been brewing steadily for the past decade. According to a PricewaterhouseCoopers study conducted last year, patent cases have been growing at a compound annual growth rate of 7% since 1991. But much of this growth is attributable to an almost 30% increase in patent cases from 2011 to 2012. Lex Machina's 2013 Patent Litigation Year in Review notes there were more than 6,000 patent lawsuits in 2013, up about 12% from 2012. Some of these cases go on for years. In essence, almost 6,000 new patent cases go to the court system every year, affecting about 15,000 entrepreneurs, investors, scientists, and companies. To put that in perspective, about 2,000 new patent cases were being filed each year between 1990 and 2000. Software giant SAS spent as much as $10 million in a single year on patent infringement cases initiated by patent trolls, says John Boswell, senior vice president and chief legal officer of the company. A patent troll is a shell company that buys up patents, usually from companies that no longer use them or have gone bankrupt. The patent troll then sues a legitimate company claiming it is violating one of those patents. It's a bona fide business where investors will come together, they'll put some money in a pot and say, let's go buy some patents, knowing what they're going to do, says Lucas Osborne, director of Campbell Law School's Intellectual Property Law Program. But patent trolls know how to work the system. They know that patent litigation can be very expensive and that for many companies it's cheaper to settle the case rather than go to court. Much of that expense has to do with the discovery phase of the litigation process. During that phase, each side asks the other for documents. The patent troll usually just has to hand over the patent. The defending company, on the other hand, can have thousands of documents and emails that contain some mention of the patented technology. Gathering all of those documents can be extremely expensive. Patent trolls hope that companies will agree to settle and simply pay the patent infringement fee rather than pursuing costly litigation, and in many cases, the ploy works. Tech companies are particularly susceptible because their software patents often contain general language describing the software's function, and it's easy for a patent troll to attack something that's more generally worded. North Carolina Senate Bill 648, which was signed into law August 6th, is a legislative attempt to change the system. The bill allows North Carolina companies to sue patent trolls that have targeted them. If the court finds that the patent troll made an intentionally dishonest demand, businesses can recover monetary damages and attorney's fees associated with any litigation plus additional punitive damages. Further, the bill allows companies to recover money from the individuals behind the patent troll's shell company, and that makes a big difference when many of those shell companies have very few assets. Boswell says he believes the ability to go after the people behind the patent trolls will discourage patent troll activity in North Carolina. They realize now, I'm putting my own house, my bank account on the line, he says. With the signing of the patent troll legislation, North Carolina has joined about 15 other states that already have anti-troll laws on the books. This article was written by Meredith Hamrick. By the numbers on this subject, a look at the patents list ranks by number of patents with participation from local inventors in the last 5 years, the top four. 2,342 patents by IBM, Cree has 388, Cisco Systems 324, and Lenovo has 236. Continuing on about patents and trolls, here's a look at inside the list. This list tracks the number of utility patents. What exactly is a utility patent, and what are the other types of patents? A utility patent may be granted to anyone who invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, article of manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof. A design patent may be granted to anyone who invents a new, original, and ornamental design for an article of manufacture. And a plant patent may be granted to anyone who invents or discovers and asexually reproduces any distinct and new variety of plant. Here are the rules of the patent game. And here are some things to keep in mind when thinking about applying for a patent. Who can apply for a patent? A patent may be applied for only in the name or names of the actual inventors. What can and cannot be patented? What can be patented? Utility patents are provided for a new, non-obvious, and useful process, machine, article of manufacture, composition of matter, improvement of any of the above. What cannot be patented? Laws of nature, physical phenomenon, abstract ideas, literary, dramatic, musical, and artistic works. These can be copyright protected. Inventions which are not useful, such as a perpetual motion machine, or offensive to public morality. The invention must also be novel, non-obvious, adequately described or enabled for one of ordinary skill in the art to make and use the invention, and claimed by the inventor in clear and definite terms. This week's Viewpoint column includes the editor's notebook. The editor of the Triangle Business Journal is Sugata Mukherjee, and his column this week is entitled, How PE Firms May Help Us Land New HQ Ops Here. We talk about the Triangle area not having enough public company headquarters, operations, and the fact that we actually lost a couple of big ones in the past couple of years, Progress Energy and RBC Bank. But thanks to Wall Street and the ever-hungry private equity firms, the Triangle may be the beneficiary of hosting a handful of prominent HQ operations with Wall Street ties, all in the clinical and contract research field. The first indication came on September 9 when Raleigh's PRA International, now called PRA Health Sciences, filed for a $375 million initial public offering with blessings from its owner, KKR Holdings. Here is the math. KKR, one of the world's most prominent private equity firms, paid $1.3 billion in 2011 to another capital firm, Genstar, which bought the private company for $797 million in 2007. While PRA was in its latest filing does not disclose the number of shares it will float, the filing does state that the money will be used to retire some $375 million in debt. So why should we care if another private equity firm is going to make gobs of money 3 years removed from the purchase date? Because deals like this have local implications. PRA currently employs about 10,000 people worldwide and more than 500 in Raleigh. It is housed within a nondescript office park near Crabtree Valley Mall. But if it is successful in going public, marketing an image of a global company becomes one of its top priorities. Just as Quintiles did some 7 years ago, expect PRA management to follow suit. New hires for HQ operations would follow as well. In short, PRA going public will help several local companies, especially since we are talking about a company with a revenue run rate of $1.4 billion. Following Quintiles and now PRA, I believe Raleigh's Inc. Research may soon follow suit with a similar move, and so could Wilmington's PPD. They are both owned by private equity players, and this is a great time for them to cash out. For us as a region that has housed the privately held CROs for more than a decade, we must seize this opportunity to solidify our foothold. This is an opening that will not last long for our economic developers, commerce partnerships, real estate companies to make a big push to get these HQs to permanently call the Triangle home. The payout is big, both in terms of jobs and the area's brand. This week's guest column is from Lou Ebert. Mr. Ebert is the president and CEO of the Raleigh-based North Carolina Chamber. His column is entitled, Jobless Insurance Reform Propels North Carolina. Over the past few months, there have been a consistent rhetoric of misinformation around unemployment insurance in North Carolina. The distorted conversation has created a misunderstanding of the impacts that last year's unemployment insurance reform has had on North Carolina's growing economy. I think it is important to share the perspective of our state's job creators. At the beginning of 2013, North Carolina employers were facing a $2.6 billion debt to the federal government for North Carolina's unemployment insurance system. In addition to being broke, the system was broken with nothing in place to protect its solvency, affordability, and integrity. House Bill 4 passed with bipartisan support and signed into law February 19, 2013, implemented reforms to address North Carolina's staggering debt to the federal government, restore trust fund solvency by 2016, enact greater accountability for the employer taxes funding the UI system, as well as create checks and balances to ensure system efficiency and re-employment. What has happened in the last year and a half is nothing short of a success story. The debt to the federal government is down from $2.6 billion to less than $600 million, and North Carolina is on track to retire the debt before November 10, 2015. Meeting this target allows our state employers to stop sending principal and interest payments to Washington and to start investing that money at home. To date, North Carolina's job creators have sent more than $200 million to Washington to cover the interest alone on this debt, with another $37 million interest payment due September 30th. In addition, we are on track to build a healthy surplus of more than $1 billion to keep the state's trust fund solvent for future downturns. North Carolina's economy is getting back on track. We have had back-to-back years of creating more than 70,000 jobs, and additionally, our state has seen one of the fastest declining unemployment rates in the country. While those numbers have been disputed by some, the attached chart shows that regardless of which unemployment figures you assess, the decline in the unemployment rate is clear. House Bill 4 provides real solutions to our state's unemployment system that encourages North Carolina businesses to create the jobs our citizens desperately need. This responsible fix was integral to providing certainty and predictability for North Carolina's job creators. And here's a quick look at some of the trends and happenings of Raleigh and Wake County. Highwoods Ed Fritch is sold on downtown Raleigh. It's one thing that Highwoods Properties has taken on huge trophy office buildings in Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Nashville, and Orlando. It's another when it's in Highwoods' backyard, the hometown of President and CEO Ed Fritch. Highwoods, on September 8th, acquired the 17-story One Bank of America Plaza building on Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh, with plans to invest $92.3 million in its acquisition and improvements. It's only the second major investment Highwoods has made in the downtown district, the first being construction of the PNC Plaza in 2008. Mr. Fritch is quoted as saying, "Raleigh's downtown is a very different market than it was when I was growing up or even 10 or 15 years ago. My wife and I were downtown last weekend, and it's a very active downtown, with or without hopscotch," referring to the annual three-day music festival that ended September 6th. Mr. Fritch likes what he sees. It's good to see that vibrancy. Also, the local hype is Triangle Cities and the Tar Heel State make headlines in recent national rankings. Number 1. Raleigh's rank among U.S. cities with the least expensive commercial office space. This comes from Building Owners and Managers Association International. Number 3. Raleigh's top rank among best up-and-coming cities for art and culture. This comes from Women's Health and the Yelp. And Top 10. Durham ranks among the 10 cheapest places you'd want to live in the United States, from Kiplinger. And here are some quotes you may not have heard about yet. Art Pope says, quote, "I am not a billionaire," end quote. The former NC budget director responding to a Brookings Institute report listing him among top billionaires with political influence. Mr. Trey Bailey is quoted as saying, "Bailey's is going global, baby." Mr. Bailey is the director of operations for the family-owned Raleigh-based Bailey's Fine Jewelry, speaking of the company's expansion into Texas with a Pandora brand store. And Mr. Roy Cooper is quoted as saying, "Fortunately, I haven't been a victim." The North Carolina Attorney General talking with the Triangle Business Journal about security breaches, like the recent incident at the Home Depot. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the TBJ. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. We hope you've enjoyed it. This program will be available online after it broadcasts, and the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.